Vic Sage and the Projectionist, hosts of the Saturday Frights podcast, while working in the Retroist vault, find themselves under assault from a force of evil, an evil from the Projectionist's past. In an effort to save the vault, they're forced to carry out an emergency lockdown. With no possibility of escape, the two must enter a makeshift portal, linking them to the Projectionist's haunted drive-in. Being shoved through the portal by his co-host, Vic Sage vanished. He awoke to find himself transported to the haunted drive-in, but in the past of an alternate timeline. Due to a malfunction in the portal, the duo were merged into one being, with Sage being stuck in the Projectionist's younger body, and his co-host trapped deep within Sage's subconscious, acting as his voice of reason. The only link to their own timeline was a portable recording device, disguised as a small briefcase, acting as their only communication to the Retroist Vault and possibly their only way home.
And now, on with the show.
I still can't believe it, Projectionist. Nancy is dead. Her whole family was murdered while we were on that road trip.
The work of Bill Darnell, Victor.
Why, though?
We were friends with her, Sage. That was all the reason Bill Darnell needed. Inadvertently, she helped us by lending her parents' automobile to us to retrieve those items we needed to build a portal to take us back to our timeline.
It's just so senseless.
As it was in our timeline.
I'm sorry, Projectionist. I didn't realize you lost Nancy, too.
Indeed. The very same way, in fact. Showing yet again that Bill Darnell is Bill Darnell in any timeline. We must be careful now, more than ever.
He looked shocked to see us show up at the funeral, that's for sure.
Perhaps the invocation befuddled his connection with the coachman of Cherry Hill. I suppose he wasn't aware that we weren't slain.
Well, he covered it pretty well at the graveside.
Unless you count how much he was sweating, eh?
Yeah, I know it sounds odd, but I think we scared him quite a bit. So how do we play this from here on out?
The same as always. Play it dumb. No reason to deviate from what we've put into motion.
Well, maybe we won't have to have a confrontation. Remember what the Retroist said in his last communication.
I remind you, do not put too much faith in the Retroist Industries technobabble, Sage.
I'm just saying that maybe... Hey, the briefcase light is on. Listeners, we just got back from Nancy and her family's funeral. While we were grave robbing in Cherry Hill, someone...
Bill Darnell.
Right. Broke into Nancy's parents' place and murdered them. The police have no suspects. There was no evidence from what Leonard told us at the funeral.
Oh, make no mistake, dear listeners. Bill Darnell did not physically do the deed himself. He conjured up some shadow demon or lesser imp to perform the task.
I'm feeling pretty drained. Let me take a seat on the cot. I think the Projectionist is right, friends. We are in a dangerous situation now. For what it's worth, there aren't any showings at the Starlight Starbright drive-in this week. Bill made a big show about it, how it was in Nancy's honor.
Of course he did. Everyone in Haddonfield looks up to Big Bill.
Don't she know he's on a stage? It's not real, it's just a play. And he's playing the part that is soon to break. Quaker house. Oh, can she see tomorrow's misery? Soon she'll learn her fate, but it'll be too late. All her friends, they...
I guess even the drive-in understands the warning is too late now.
That isn't what she was saying, Victor.
What do you mean?
Nothing. Best not to think about it. What will come. Here now. There is much to be glum about, but we couldn't have done anything for that sweet lass. Let us change the subject. How about we get to work on the latest Saturday Frights radio broadcast, eh?
Feels like we picked an appropriate movie to discuss with you listeners this go-around, friends. This week, we're going to be talking about 1981's Ghost Story. This is a movie I originally saw at the 62 Drive-In, back when I was a kid, projectionist.
Oh my, when it was first released, in December of 1981...
Actually, no. I've come to realize something, my friends. There were some exceptions, but having the privilege of talking horror TV and movies with you now for the past 61 episodes, it certainly seems like the 62 Drive-In didn't exactly get first-run movies.
I can assure you it cost quite a bit of money to rent those first-run films, Sage. Unless... of course, you had other ways of obtaining prints.
I recall seeing it during the spring of 1982. I want to say that The Changeling was maybe the second feature?
I highly doubt that. The Changeling was released in 1980.
Yeah, that wouldn't be right then. Anyway, my father and I were quite excited to see it. Thanks in no small part to the simple but creepy theatrical one-sheets hanging in the concession stand. And of course, the television ads.
The house is so empty. The town is so still. The truth, never buried, has come back to kill. The cold wind shrieks. The full moon's pale. The time has come to tell the tale. Fred Astaire, Melvin Douglas, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., John Houseman, Ghost Story, based on Peter Straub's terrifying bestseller, Rated R. Now playing at a theater near you.
As a teenager, did the film give you the frights?
Teenager? I was like 10 years old, projectionist. But it did scare me. In a good way, though. Not like having trouble getting to sleep, like after watching Poltergeist. The movie delivered on exactly what is promised, and in spades. It's a brilliant ghost story.
I concur. It is, in fact, a very well-made film. Now, it is also helped with the cast of thespians they chose. To borrow the tagline from many of the posters, to tell the tale.
I agree, my friend. As you heard in that television commercial, you had John Houseman, Douglas Fairbanks Jr.
While there are some critics who do not feel that Douglas Fairbanks Jr. inherited from his legendary father, Douglas Fairbanks Sr., the gift of acting, I would challenge those naysayers to watch his performances in 1931's Little Caesar or 1939's Gunga Din.
Wow, projectionist. Haven't heard you this fired up in quite some time. Maybe we should do another podcast just about classic films.
No speaking nonsense.
Well, Ghost Story also had Fred Astaire, Craig Wasson, Melvin Douglas, Patricia Neal, and most importantly, Alice Krieg.
Yes, she handles the beautiful and beastly aspects of her character. Or, should I say, characters quite splendidly. Were you aware dear listeners, that Ghost Story marked the final feature film appearances for three of its cast: Fred Astaire, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., and Melvin Douglas.
Also of note is that Melvin Douglas was seen the previous year in 1980's stellar movie, The Changeling. Now, before we dive in too deep in the interesting facts, how about I start the synopsis?
By all means, get on with it.
While I will try to be brief, please understand this will be a full synopsis. So, if you haven't had the pleasure of seeing Ghost Story for yourself, friends, you might want to stop listening and go watch it first.
Get on with it, Victor.
Okay. Ghost Story begins in a then-modern-day New England town called Millburn during the dead of winter. We are then introduced to four elderly gentlemen, well-to-do members of the town and lifelong friends, who meet to tell each other ghost stories. A little club they've dubbed the Chowder Society. The group consists of Mayor Edward Charles Wanderley, played by Douglas Fairbanks Jr., Dr. John Jeffrey, portrayed by Melvin Douglas, attorney Sears James, played by John Houseman, and successful businessman Ricky Hawthorne, who is played by Fred Astaire. I think it's interesting that in some of the vintage reviews, both Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and Melvin Douglas got pretty much savaged by the critics for their performances, which I totally can't understand, because these four veterans bring their A-game.
These four men of power and of good standing in Millburn are tied to each other more than simply being members of this Chowder Society, and their appreciation of a good horror story. They all share a dirty secret.
Absolutely. A dark deed from their past that has returned to not make just them pay for their misdeeds, but in the case of Charles Wanderley, it affects his two sons, David and Don, both played by Craig Wasson.
It affects David right out of a skyscraper window, where he plummets to his death, dear listeners.
It's a rather shocking moment where a woman he has been romantic with turns over while talking to him to reveal she is a waterlogged corpse. A gruesome shock, with half her face rotted away. Real quick, I've not had the chance to read the novel this movie is based on by Peter Straub. Although, I do know that Stephen King himself holds the book in high regards, as he was once quoted as saying it was probably the best of the supernatural novels since the other, The Exorcist, and Rosemary's Baby. I've heard there's some rather heavy differences between the two forms of media. Ghost Story is to me a little like 1979's Phantasm. Things feel very dreamlike in the logic and flow of the movie.
Do you feel, Victor, that the ghost is a real presence in this film? Or is it in fact representing merely the guilt of the members of the Chowder Society? That guilt reaching a point that they can no longer handle it.
Oh, I definitely believe there's a supernatural presence in Ghost Story. Why would David die over the guilt his father was feeling about an action from his own youth?
Perhaps David Wanderley found out the truth of what his dear father had done and couldn't live with the knowledge and took his own life.
That's interesting, projectionist, but no, I'm sorry. There's a real ghost in Ghost Story. Back to the synopsis. Don has his own secret. The woman his brother was sleeping with, well, he'd been in a relationship with her first, in Florida, where he'd been a professor, and she his secretary. After the affair was over, though, he finds his reputation in shambles. Don, unlike his brother, was able to realize something wasn't quite right with the young woman, who is named Alma, played wonderfully, of course, by Alice Krieg. Realizing the power she holds over him, he breaks off their relationship and attempts to salvage his life. Alma apparently wastes no time in making a beeline for New York City and David. It's David's death that has Mayor Wanderley call his remaining son to his side for the funeral.
It seems like Don Wanderley is the black sheep of the family. Or at least he is treated as such.
Yeah, more than a little. The elder Wanderley definitely seems to take part in favoritism. The night that Dawn arrives in Milburn, every single member of the Chowder Society is plagued with horrid dreams. In the case of Edward Wanderley, he has a nightmarish vision of what would have been David's wedding, not only startling the elder man awake, but forcing him from his bed to wander the snowy streets, following what he believes is his dead son. Until he finds himself on a bridge spanning a frozen river below. We, the viewers, see and hear him react to a familiar and haunting voice before he turns around and is confronted by a waterlogged monstrosity crying his name. The action causes Edward to leap back from the thing. Losing his balance, he tumbles over the bridge railing to die on the ice below. This event was witnessed by a town local driving a snowplow. Of course, he didn't see the ghost that startled Edward. So it is believed the mayor was overcome with grief and committed suicide. While Don does not buy this, his father's three friends remain tight-lipped about the events in the past that is the cause of all this supernatural goings-on. We are also given the impression that every evening they are continuously experiencing horrible visions. I mean, for a very long time.
A sure sign of a guilty conscience.
Well, one of the nightmares is finally so bad that it ends up causing Dr. Jeffrey to die of a heart attack, as one more member of the Chowder Society is laid to rest. With this in Don's story about Alma and his brother, it causes both Ricky and Sears to open up to the young man. And we, the viewers, learn what has caused this ghostly vengeance.
This is the worst story we know.
The worst thing that ever happened to us.
Most dreadful thing.
We thought we could keep it a secret.
Should have known better.
Guilt. After all this time, we thought it had nothing to do with any of our problems. Now John's dead, too. If I had...
Don't blame yourself.
I used to malign him terribly, but... Eva Galley. I've said it.
Yeah.
Well, what happened to her?
Well, that's obvious, isn't it?
We killed her.
The two of you?
All of us.
The Chowder Society. In the spring of 50 years ago.
That was the start of it.
The beginning.
Eva Galley, also played by Alice Krieg, is a coquettish young woman that the Chowder Society befriends in the 30s. It's not long before Edward feels more than friendship for Eva, and she too is attracted to the young man. Although, to be fair, each of the young men has a crush on the young woman. Things come to a head, though, when Edward and Eva spend the night together. And while nothing happens due to, issues. Later on that evening, as the Chowder Society gathers, and they have all had too much to drink, Edward boasts about his supposed conquest. This gets the group fired up, and they all pay Eva a visit at her home. Now this, friends, is one uncomfortable scene to say the least, especially when we see the younger Sears James insist that he gets to have his dance with Eva. You can read the subtext in his statement. The young woman is, of course, taken back, but she turns the tables on the drunkards when she appears to be aggressive. However, when she realizes that Edward has been telling tales, she threatens to let the Chowder Society know what really happened in her bedroom earlier that night.
Or didn't happen in this case.
Edward becomes furious at the thought of her telling everyone about his
shortcomings.
Moving on, Edward leaps up to put his hand on Eva's mouth before she can say anything, and instead ends up pushing her. She loses her balance and cracks her skull against the fireplace, where she lays motionless. It is John, of course, since he was a medical student at that point in time, that checks for a pulse, and to the young men's horror, delivers the verdict that Eva is dead. So the Chowder Society decides that while the accidental murder is a horrid thing, it will only destroy their burgeoning careers if they go to the authorities. A what's done is done philosophy. Now, I feel we should point out, for what little it's worth, that Edward did in fact love Eva. He is absolutely destroyed by what he did. Actually, all of the Chowder Society are incredibly remorseful. It was just a horrible accident.
Perhaps. They are not so devastated, however, as to refuse to take part in placing her lifeless body inside her automobile, and then sending it to the bottom of the Dedham Pond.
Remember how drunk I said the Chowder Society was? We learn John made a mistake due to his inebriation. As we see the car start to sink under the water, Eva races up from the back seat calling for Edward, banging on the glass with her fists, screaming as the water sucks her and the vehicle straight down.
Yes, now they truly are murderers.
Edward does attempt to reach her, but it's to no avail. Eva Galli drowns, and the Chowder Society vow never to speak of it again and go about their lives, becoming patriarchs of the little town they grew up in. As you've no doubt pieced together by now, Eva and Ada are of course the same person. The same entity, I should say. And judging by her actions, she believes it's time to pay the piper. Don and Ricky are of one mind on this matter. It's helped by the fact that the young man found a photo in his father's home of Eva, who, of course, is the spitting image of Ada. Sears is skeptical about all of this, to say the least. It's Don who feels the three should actually visit Eva's old home, which has been left to rot since the incident 50 years ago.
Except it is not quite vacant, is it, Victor?
No, it's not. As Eva has managed to secure the help of two brothers, Gregory and his younger brother, Finney. Two disciples, as it were, I guess, to do her bidding.
I was rather confused by these two characters, Sage. Did they have additional scenes that were cut out?
I know what you mean, Projectionist. These two characters seem to be rather peripheral. They serve only to deliver a promise of horrible retribution to Don earlier in the film, and, in the case of Finney, offing Sears, after the older man goes to get help for Don, who broke his leg while they're exploring Eva's place. We do learn, though, why the two are working for her when it's Ricky's turn to get help after Sears fails to return. The problem is, he's picked up by Gregory, and things aren't looking too rosy for the older man's future.
Don't struggle or I'll kill you right now.
You hear me?
You be quiet?
Yeah.
Got a little wrecked.
Why are you doing this?
Would you like to live forever, Ricky? Yeah, that's what she promised us. Imagine the peace of lying down with your hands across your chest.
You go to hell.
Imagine her waiting for you all these years. Imagine her sleeping under ice and snow. Waiting.
The pond.
Would you like to be immortal? Even if you must die first?
Good Lord, she's in the pond.
Alive. Still alive.
She tricked you. You won't live forever.
I live longer than you.
Oh, no, you won't.
Listeners, Ricky actually stabs Gregory, causing the car to wreck. But he now knows what needs to be done to stop Eva. The older man goes to the authorities and has them drive to Dedham Pond and raise Eva's car from the depths.
Which is very good timing for Don Wanderley, as he's having a frightening chat with Eva Galli, who is enjoying tormenting the young man, revealing her true rotted form as Don screams in terror. This is all happening at the exact same moment the car is dragged from the pond and Ricky manages to wrench the car door open and the decomposing corpse of Eva Galli stumbles out and deteriorates before the old man and the constables.
Exactly. This action causes the specter of vengeance to just disappear. saving Dawn. As the film ends, Ricky looks on sadly and knowingly at the remains of Eva, and we see the snow has stopped, and the sun is finally shining on Milburn at last. The curse, it would appear, is broken. I know I painted the synopsis this time with pretty broad strokes, but that way you can still be surprised by the movie when watching it.
What do you believe happens after the credits roll, Victor?
What do you mean, projectionist?
I'm referring to the fact that Ricky Hawthorne will have to explain to the constables of how he knew a car was hidden beneath that icy pond.
Well, he might very well fess up to the murder from so many years ago. I mean, the silence of the deed is what caused Eva to go on a rampage in the first place, right?
Oh, perhaps he should chalk it up to Gregory Bates, an escaped mental patient.
Well, he might, but even though it means he will probably go to jail, I feel Ricky learned about keeping things quiet from these events. That was the whole point of the story, right? By the way, I've mentioned throughout the synopsis the rather gruesome-looking effects in the movie. These were supervised by none other than Dick Smith, whose work you might know from The Godfather, The Exorcist, and Amadeus, to name a few. One of his effects, while commonly seen in magazines, featuring a basically featureless Eva with red flowing hair and a gaping maw with rotten teeth, wasn't seen in the final cut of the movie. It did, however, find a use in the 1999 remake of William Castle's House on Haunted Hill, only a mere 18 years later.
I do not believe I need to see this remake of William Castle's masterpiece.
I don't know, my friend. I quite like it, personally. I thought it even pays respect to the original. Now, I mentioned earlier that Ghost Story was not exactly looked on fondly upon its release in 1981. In fact, one of the movie's few defenders was the late Roger Ebert, who felt it improved aspects of the story by Straub. I couldn't locate the cost of the making of Ghost Story, but I do know it made $23 million in its original theatrical run. So it surely must have made its money back. I mean, friends, 1982's Tron cost $17 million and had a whole heck of a lot more effects than this movie.
Sage, another aspect of this film to point out is the chilling score by Felipe Sade.
Oh, indeed. Not exactly a soundtrack you should be listening to while taking a long walk in the dark. Projectionist, do you have any vintage trailers for the listeners?
I most certainly do. However, I wish to wait until the end of our radio broadcast to share it. Let us say it is the perfect film to discuss on Halloween.
Oh, wow. Okay, if it's the movie I think you're hinting at, the listeners are going to freak out. The director of Ghost Story was John Irvin, who also helmed 1986's Raw Deal with Arnold Schwarzenegger. The following year, he directed Hamburger Hill, and in 1989, directed one of my guilty pleasures, Next of Kin, with Patrick Swayze, Liam Neeson, and Bill Paxton. Now, the screenplay that was adapted from Straub's novel was done by Lawrence D. Cohen, who is obviously a Stephen King fan, as he wrote the script for 1976's Carrie, the 1990 TV miniseries for It, 1993's Tommyknockers, and 2006's segment for Nightmares and Dreamscapes entitled The End of the Whole Mess, which we will cover on the show at some point. Fred Astaire is probably best known for being a song and dance man, like in 1935's Top Hat or 1957's Funny Face. He was also in 1959's Sobering on the Beach, 1968's Finian's Rainbow, and 1970's epic disaster film The Towering Inferno. Of course, he also provided his voice for 1970's Santa Claus is Coming to Town and 1977's The Easter Bunny is Coming to Town. Melvin Douglas, besides appearing in 1980's The Changeling, was well known for his roles in 1963's Hud, where he co-starred with Patricia Neal, 1965's Inherit the Wind, and in 1979's Being There. Douglas Fairbanks Jr., as the projectionist mentioned, was indeed in Little Caesar and Gunga Din, but he was also known for his work in 1937's The Prisoner of Zenda, 1947's Sinbad the Sailor, and 1949's The Fighting O'Flynn. John Houseman might be best known for his role in the long-running TV series The Paper Chase as Richard Professor Charles W. Kingsfield Jr., but he was also in 1975's The 3 Days of the Condor and the cult classic Rollerball, as well as 1980's The Fog. I remember him best, actually, from his guest appearances as Grandpa Stratton from the hit series Silver Spoons. Craig Wasson went on to appear in Brian De Palma's 1984 thriller Body Double, where he co-starred with the likes of Melanie Griffith, Greg Henry, Deborah Shelton, and Dennis Franz. Craig also went against another supernatural entity when he starred in 1987's A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors. In 1981, Alice Creed could also be seen in Chariots of Fire. Before moving on to 1987's Barfly, 1992's Sleepwalkers, 1996's Star Trek First Contact as the Borg Queen, 2003's TV miniseries Dune, where she played Lady Jessica of House Atreides, and in 2006, she portrayed the evil Christabella in Silent Hill. I think that about wraps up this episode, friends.
Why is the briefcase making that noise, Victor?
I don't know, projectionist. We have a message from the Retroist.
Vic, it's time for you to come home.
It's a portal, projectionist!
Grab the briefcase, you dolt! Enter the portal before it closes.
I can't believe it! We're going home!
Be continued.